Sarah, you spent almost 6 years studying failure. Why? What's so compelling about failure?
You know, creativity and path-breaking human endeavor is a mystery, but you really do come closer to it when you start to understand the gifts of not just failure, but setbacks and obstacles. And as someone, you know, I came to it organically because I myself had failed and had learned a lot from it as a teenager. But when I went into the arts, I would see these backturned paintings in artist studios and saw that they didn't want to show me those paintings, but they did really help them create what it was they were very proud of. And I thought that it would be just important to make sure that we had this conversation in public about the nature of this gift of failure.
Why do you call it a gift?
There's so many advantages that come from this process. I think we often, and we all should, want to be accomplished and have a certain level of achievement. But there are things that failure teaches that nothing else can. And that's really in part why the word gift is so important to me when thinking about this topic.
Mm. And you went to Harvard, a place that is has historically been so averse to failure. I've heard it said that it's virtually impossible to flunk out. So you know what it's like to be on a success track. But near the beginning of your book, you write that even as a teenager, you were beginning to live with the gift of what it means to be underestimated. What do you mean?
Well, you're right about Harvard to a certain extent, although I should say Harvard created the Success Failure Project very recently.
What's that?
Because it's a place where various individuals from the dean of Harvard College Admissions, who himself was expelled from high school, actually, and learned a great deal about resilience, something he looks for in Harvard applicants. He himself will speak on a panel with various others through the Success Failure Project to make sure that we're all looking at what gifts do come from adversity. So it's housed at the Bureau for Study at Harvard, and it's, I think, also connected to career services. But it's a really holistic way of looking at human endeavor.
Though I'm sorry, there's something so amusing about of course, students who go to Harvard have to be taught how to fail.
Well, you know, Drew Faust, the president of Harvard, has said, that's right, Harvard students are very used to being successful. Being seen as a failure, it goes against, you know, your understanding of yourself, so you do need some support. But I think it's important to feel as if you're in lineage. When you look at the lives of so many individuals, from Martin Luther King to J.K. Rowling, Oprah, you start to understand that we really do need to master this. It's the one thing we're never really taught. Being underestimated, though, for me personally, did propel me on this journey. I think it's a unique experience when someone looks at you because of maybe your youth or your gender or your race, and without even opening my mouth, I know that I might be seen as a failure to meet a kind of standard in some people's minds. So it was a very kind of subconscious idea, thinking about the gift of being underestimated, but it certainly made me want to see how others had taken uncommon foundations and found in them, you know, strengths to have their own rise.
One of the things that's kind of comforting about reading your book is discovering how many people have created what we consider masterpieces, you know, in writing or art or science, who actually considered their own work to be deeply flawed or even, you know, failure in some way or another. You write about Faulkner, for instance, who wrote The Sound and the Fury, never really thought it was done.
Isn't that incredible? He didn't. After he published it and went on to achieve its iconic status, he felt that it was a near win, something I talk about a lot in The Rise. He published subsequent editions, different parts of the book he wanted to improve, as an appendix 16 years later. You know, he had an experience that many masters do, which is that there's a sense of incompletion in their project. So another example would be Paul Cézanne, who signed just under 10% of his paintings because he thought that the rest of the 90% were really incomplete. They didn't really meet his goal.
Wow.
Of course. Yeah. It's just amazing.
So what do you mean when you talk about a near win?
Right. The near win, coming close to your goal but not meeting it, you know, in athletic competition, it's an Olympic silver medalist or bronze medalist, for example, sometimes gives you propulsion that you never would have had if you actually met your goal, and through it can find kind of groundbreaking endeavors and achievements. There's an interesting study that came out of Cornell. There was a study about these Olympic silver medalists versus bronze medalists, and the researchers found that the frustration that the silver medalist had compared to bronze medalist being happy to just not have received fourth place, made silver medalist really focus on follow-up competition in a way that bronze medalist did not. And that we see in many different athletic achievements, from a Jackie Joyner-Kersee or a Julie Moss, whose near win popularized Ironman competitions. So the sense of the near win, I think, is a really interesting way to look at the kind of propulsion that we need to live in a way that focuses on not just success, but mastery, as I see it, this sort of journey of ever onward almosts that over a course of a lifetime can result in really iconic achievements.
But that's really fascinating, because one of the things you're saying is it's not just any old failure you need. There are good failures and even better failures in terms
that's
of
right.
their ability to motivate.
I love the way you put that. That's right. There are better failures than others, and coming close is one of them. We all experience this sort of gradation of failures in life. I mean, one of the ways of thinking about why the near win is so impactful is to imagine this sort of scenario. Say you're going to the airport and you get there 5 minutes late and you miss your flight. Compare that to the way you'd feel if you missed the flight by 30 minutes. If you miss it by 5 minutes, you'll
that's
probably
worse.
Never miss.
Right.
Exactly.
That's a lot worse.
Right. It feels much worse. So that's the same phenomenon that's going on with these athletes and inventors and artists and entrepreneurs.
That makes me think of the Silicon Valley mantra, fail better. In fact, you write about there's a whole Silicon Valley conference, or at least it started in the Silicon Valley, called FailCon.
That's right. Yep. FailCon is a place where entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, and now around the world, there are many of them, go and can only speak about their failures. And we're not just talking about, any entrepreneur. We're talking about entrepreneurs who have achieved incredible levels of quote-unquote success, from Travis Kalanick, who founded Uber, to Vinod Khosla. And I went there, and I had been steeped in stories of failure to triumph for about 2 years, interviewed over 150 individuals for The Rise. But I was still so surprised by how forthcoming people were on the stage there at FailCon. FailCon is an annual conference, about 500 individuals, keynote speeches. But there's a level of vulnerability that comes when you can only speak about your failure, when you can't couch it in a sort of neatly packaged story. But the idea that you have to take a risk, that you have to be willing to fail in order to innovate, is so critical that, it's important to have a safe space in order to speak about these stories.
It's funny because I'm thinking, the thing is, we all know this, right? I mean, we've all grown up hearing famous quotations like Edison's famous line, "I haven't failed, I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." Mm-hmm. We've all heard that geniuses aren't people who succeed more often, they're just people who have failed more often. But, the problem is that nobody actually wants to fail.
Exactly. In fact, we were talking about the Harvard Success Failure Project earlier. The woman who runs it, Abigail Lipsum, said to me, "Sarah, when you write this book, I just want to make sure you get this point across, that in order to benefit from failure, you do have to first let yourself feel pretty badly about it," she said. And, she's right. I think that's in large part why we do know this, that failure can be an advantage, but we don't want to live it out, of course, because you have to go to a difficult place in order to get the sort of jewels that come from it. But then there's some stories where, like Fred Astaire, you mentioned Edison. I was thinking about Fred Astaire, who such an icon of dance, and his RKO screen test in the 1930s was can't sing, can't act, can dance a little, balding. You know? Ouch. And you just think it happens to everyone.
Yeah. But so so how, what is it we have to do in order to embrace failure? Because as you said, you know, it feels crappy.
There are a number of techniques I've seen now that people use. I'll give you a few examples. One is to give yourself some distance from the experience. Angela Duckworth, who focuses on grit down at the University of Pennsylvania, she has told me that if she receives, say, a rejection from a grant, she'll put it in a folder and give herself some time away from it and then come back to it so that she can extract the gains that come from information, really. And that is what failure is. It's information. But some of the difficulty is when we have such pain about it that we just can't see it. Twyla Tharp, for example, she would often have someone read critique to her so that they could kind of take the poison out of it and deliver the information. Friday Night Experiments, the two Nobel Prize winners in physics who discovered the first two-dimensional object on the Earth, they have this method, what they call Friday Night Experiments, of taking some structured time to sort of just play, to let themselves do things that might be foolish to other people. But through it, you know, they can fail and then find something path-breaking and new, as they did to win the Nobel Prize.
Now, this is a fascinating chapter that you had. You're talking about the Nobel Prize-winning physicists. I'm not going to know how to say their names. Can you?
Oh, sure. André Geim and Konstantin Novoslav. Okay. Not so easy.
Right. So you spent some time with the Nobel Prize-winning physicists André Geim and Konstantin Novoslav. God, I've done it wrong. Say it again.
Oh, it's Novoslav?
Novoslav. Yeah. Konstantin Novoslav. And they won the Nobel Prize for, what was it, something about graphene?
Yes, they isolated graphene. It was the first time someone has isolated a two-dimensional object on the Earth, ever. And it was something that physicists didn't think could be done.
Yeah. And the Friday Night Experiments are this fascinating thing they do because you think of science as being so serious and also at the level that they do science, fairly driven. But they take one day out a week from their lab to do sort of ridiculous stuff.
That's right. That's right. André, in his Nobel Prize interview, actually said that he sometimes jokes that he doesn't research, he only does search, you know. He, in other words, he's looking at his scientific career as an adventure, ultimately. But part of that is about letting curiosity, you know, guide you. The trouble is, when you do serious science, it's hard to find safe spaces to do that because of funding and other things. So, yeah, 10% of their laboratory time is spent letting themselves really find ways to graze, as they call it, to kind of enter other people's fields and to come up with incredible inventions because of it. One of them was that they levitated a frog with magnets. And that won André the Ig Nobel Award in 2000. It's really a joke award. And no one has won a Nobel Prize after winning an Ig Nobel. Maybe others now will. He also invented gecko tape, which, you know, mimics like the hairs in a gecko's feet and allows humans to affix themselves to walls and things in these Friday Night Experiments. But this is the key. All of their award-winning scientific discoveries have come from these Friday Night Experiments. So 10% of their lab time, freedom, safe haven, space to play, you know, and there you go.
Well, and I suppose the feeling of there being very low stakes, because after all, they're not necessarily expecting much to come from a Friday night experiment. It's meant to be playful.
That's right. That's right. And actually, they limit the amount of time that the grad students and postdocs can work in on the Friday night experiments because they know most of them won't work out. Right. So very low stakes.
So you also interviewed a British explorer, Ben Saunders. He's a polar explorer. What did you learn about failure from him?
This is fascinating. Ben is someone who you would think has a sort of superhuman ability in him. He has been the third person in the world ever to go to the North Pole solo and on foot, and now the first person in the world to go to the South Pole and back from the rim of Antarctica. And what I learned from him was the importance of surrender as a way of finding strength in difficult endeavor. Surrender, for most people, means giving up. But when he was in the Arctic, for example, and he was in sub-50 degree Celsius temperatures and feeling that all of his attempts over 12 hours to go forward were being erased because the ice sheets are moving backwards, which often happened, that there was nothing more that he could do but surrender to the fact of this harsh environment, to not resist it, to not fight it, and in that process to maintain this sort of access to the internal resources that he needed to keep moving forward. Now, I mean, surrender is something, a metaphor for it is sort of the martial art of Aikido, which Bruce Lee called the most perfect art, right? It's the martial art with no kicks in it. It's just about absorbing the energy from an attack and redirecting that energy into the ground, finding a way to sort of get kicked but rise up stronger. And I think surrender has a really important place in all of our lives when it comes to transforming so-called failure into triumph.
Well, that's really interesting because one of the things that we often say about failure, I think, is we focus on how important it is to get up, you know, to think of Rocky, you know, the image of the hero or the would-be hero who's just going to, no matter what happens, is just going to come back fighting. Surrender is a really different image, right? Surrender implies just giving up. But I think... go ahead.
Oh, no, please. Yeah.
Well, I sense that there's a subtle difference there, but one that you think is really important.
Absolutely. So, for example, we might never have read any of, you know, Ezra Pound's poetry if he hadn't surrendered. He saw the novel at first as his given artistic form, right? But eventually would toss those novels into the fire and found that poems were a better form for what he wanted to say. August Wilson, kind of same thing. He started writing poems and became this award-winning playwright when he switched forms. That, to me, is a mode of surrender, right? So it is important to have grit and to keep going. It is important to be a Rocky, but there is this paradox in life that oftentimes it's actually that moment that you surrender that you find your greatest strength and sometimes a new path. Maybe the most vivid example of this, beyond Ben Saunders, and I think he's the classic one, is a timeless example, and that's Samuel F.B. Morse, who invented the telegraph. But he spent 26 years in what he thought was the failed pursuit of being not just a painter, but a painter of real renown. He wanted to be kind of a Michelangelo, a Titian. And after he didn't, at this moment, after 26 years, where he couldn't support his family, himself, he wasn't getting the acclaim he wanted, and he was failing in any attempt to get a commission from Congress to paint there, he converted the stretcher bars of the canvas itself into the telegraph. And surrendered himself to the fact that there was this interest in being an inventor in him and pursued that path.
It's what Jung called the unlived life inside all of us, right? That we all have more than one life. We often, or more than one identity, but we often tend to live out just one.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. In fact, Ben Saunders has a coach. This is another topic, how we help ourselves in this process. He has a coach who he speaks to before he sets out on this expeditions. And Jerry Colonna is his name. He himself has that Jungian feeling. His sort of unlived life is to be this sort of crazy wanderer, as he puts it. And so I think oftentimes these stories, the Morse, the Ben Saunders, August Wilson, help people to discover and to find the courage to live out their unlived life as well.
There's a quotation in your book, I jotted it down, but I don't know who said it, or I didn't jot down who said it. Mm-hmm. We fail because we have not learned to die. Mm-hmm. Is failure or how we deal with failure related to how we deal with death or don't?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's John Kenneth Galbraith quote, and I do believe that's true. For me, I coped with what I call kind of compound grief. I had a number of friends die in quick succession, and the low that it brought me to gave me a sense of joy and freedom about how I wanted to live in the end when I surrendered to the fact of death, not just the idea of it. And the story I tell in The Rise, in the book, is about Martin Luther King and how surrendering in this way to death liberated him in such a powerful way. He developed a verbal tic at the end of his life. And it was a kind of a tic that would happen not when he was giving a major speech, but kind of at the beginning of them, as Harry Belafonte recounts and tells. And eventually, Harry Belafonte asked King why the tic just went away. Eventually, they stopped noticing it. And King said that when he surrendered himself to death, he felt that there was nothing left to fear, and the tic just went away, you know?
He was having the tic because he was under so much stress and so much pressure and was receiving death threats?
Well, he never said as much. I do also, there was a moment that inspired me to write the book where I saw that on his transcript from seminary, he received C's in oratory class twice. Oh. So who knows? There might be something that was latent there. I don't know. I've not seen him go on record about why the tic came. But for such a prodigious orator to have a tic probably felt like a failure of some kind, right? So the only way for him to overcome it was to surrender in this really profound way.
Hmm. Yeah. Sarah, I noticed that you hardly ever use the word failure in your book, considering that it's an entire book about the virtues of failure. Do you feel like that word carries just too many negative connotations? I mean, do we need something else?
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you brought this up, and that's exactly right. I don't use the word very much for a couple of reasons. The first is when people transform from it, they very rarely use that word to describe the experience. They call it, you know, transformation, a learning experience, a trial. And I think all of these words are far more accurate to describe the dynamic that failure can inspire. I think it's important. The second thing is just to remember that the word failure was never meant for us. It was a 19th century term that came into usage in America to signify bankruptcy, right? Hmm. It was about reaching a dead end. But, you know, the human spirit isn't like that. We don't ever have just a dead end until the end. It's always dynamic, our life, right? We're always finding a way to go onward. There might be hills and valleys, but it's always onward. And so I think that static quality about the word failure is why we resist it. I am on the hunt for another word. I think the word actually blankness that came up a lot in the 19th century to describe that feeling people have when they don't know what to do next, sort of a failure, can be more interesting, a little more evocative, because blankness is it's such a beautiful way to describe the sort of wiping of the slate that can happen after failure.
Sure, and the sort of blankness is an empty page waiting for something to be written on it, or an empty canvas.
Exactly, yeah. Sort of limitlessness of that idea is what I want to get across in the book, in The Rise. So I am on the hunt. I don't know, do you feel that the word is really accurate, or are you too looking for another word for it?
I think I'm looking for another word also. I hadn't really thought about it until you said just now that people who have experienced failure don't talk about it that way. Mm-hmm. I had a conflict come up at work, oh, I don't know, a year ago or something, that was a pretty serious conflict. And at the time, it really rocked me. And I think I thought that I was being told that I had failed at something. Mm-hmm. It's one of the best things that ever happened to me, actually. Mm-hmm. I grew tremendously from it, hugely. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful to people now who, you know, told me some things that I didn't want to hear.
Mm-hmm. And you probably wouldn't look back on it and say, oh, that was the failure. You might call it like...
No,
like,
I'd call it something else, but not a failure.
Exactly. Exactly.
Crisis, yeah. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So right. We were talking about the limitations of the word failure. So mm-hmm. Conversely, what about the word success? Because that's mm-hmm. another word I think we... that gives us problems.
It does. You know, I spend a lot of time in The Rise talking about what I think we should be focusing on really instead of success, and that is mastery. Success I see as a status that people sort of confer on you when you hit a sort of level of achievement, you find there's some kind of status you've attained that makes you seem like a success to people. But internally, I think we always have this gap between where we are and where we want to go. And mastery, I believe, is about this sort of gap constantly inspiring our journey onward, whether it's through the near win that we talked about earlier with Cézanne not feeling that his paintings are complete or William Faulkner not feeling that his work is complete. And mastery has a kind of requires that propulsion because it is not really just about excellence. You know, it's about this ever onward almost, as I call it in the book. I think success is something that people consider the opposite of so-called failure. I wouldn't say that's true. I think the opposite of anything that we're calling failure instead is transformation or reconciliation or, you know, or arise.
And success also, success implies external judgment, don't you think?
Yep, absolutely.
And mastery is purely internal. It's an internal experience mm-hmm. when you feel mm-hmm. that you have mastered whatever, you know, your craft or occupation is.
That's exactly it. You know, and much of what we're talking about is so invisible, you know, because mastery is internal. And even seeming failure is internal, right? Someone can feel like a failure, but outwardly look like a success to other people, right? Because there's still so much more they want to do to close their gap. So for me, looking at success became, in this sort of more critical way, became easier when I started to work in the arts because you start to look at the lives of these incredible masters, like, say, a Herman Melville, you know, who published Moby Dick and knew that he had published Moby Dick, but also knew that it would take the 70 years that it did for the work to become acclaimed and for him as an author to be seen as a success. So what allows for an artist to kind of keep going when they know that their work has merit, right, but they haven't been conferred with that label of success? So I think mastery is very important for people who are looking to innovate or to create really anything in their lives, mm-hmm. to not pin it so much on external judgment.
So I'm curious, yeah. How has spending all this time and effort studying failure changed the way you approached your own creative work?
Yeah. Well, it's definitely made me excited about anything that comes my way, you know, because I can see the gift in things that have a kind of dingy gleam more than I could before. So it's made me more fearless. It's made me just more excited, and I was pretty excited about, you know, things that come in life before. It's also made me, I think, even more compassionate than I maybe was before about everyone's lives. I saw a quote the other day that said, everyone you meet is engaged with some great battle you know nothing about. It's sort of true, because so much of this is very invisible. Mm-hmm. I teach up at Yale in the MFA program, and when I'm in artist studios, painters or photographers, I find that I'm really talking about this topic with them. So I think it's made me an even better teacher and curator, too.
Mm. Well, thank you. Thanks for sharing your accumulated wisdom with us.
Well, such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.